Two or three together are to go openly over the land, by day or night, when it can be avoided.
"Nothing or a double helping is your way," said Mary. "I'm afraid I wasn't looking beyond tonight's bed. Where and what are Helm's Deep and all the rest of it? I don't know anything about this country."
"Then you'd best learn something, if you wish to understand what's happening, but not just now, and not from me. I've too many pressing things to think about."
"All right, I'll tackle Strider by the campfire. He's less testy. But why all this secrecy? I thought we'd won the battle."
"Yes, we've won, but only the first victory, and that in itself increases our danger. There was some link between Isengard and Mordor, which I've not yet fathomed. How they exchanged news I'm not sure, but they did so. The Eye of Barad-dûr will be looking impatiently towards the Wizard Vale, I think, and towards Rohan. The less it sees, the better."
The road passed slowly, winding down the valley. Now further, and now nearer, Isen flowed in its stony bed. Night came down from the mountains. All the mists were gone. A chill wind blew. The moon, now waxing round, filled the eastern sky with a pale, cold sheen. The shoulders of the mountain to their right sloped down to bare hills. The wide plains opened grey before them. At last they halted. Then they turned aside, leaving the highway and taking to the sweet upland turf again. Going westward a mile or so, they came to a dale. It opened southward, leaning back into the slope of round Dol Baran, the last hill of the northern ranges, green-footed, crowned with heather. The sides of the glen were shaggy with last year's bracken, among which the tight-curled fronds of spring were just thrusting through the sweet-scented earth. Thorn bushes grew thick upon the low banks, and under them they made their camp, 2 hours or so before the middle of the night. They lit a fire in a hollow, down among the roots of a spreading hawthorn, tall as a tree, writhen with age, but hale in every limb. Buds were swelling at each twig's tip. Guards were set, two at a watch. The rest, after they had supped, wrapped themselves in a cloak and blanket and slept. The hobbits lay in a corner by themselves upon a pile of old bracken. Merry was sleepy, but Pippin now seemed curiously restless. The bracken cracked and rustled as he twisted and turned. "What's the matter?" asked Merry. "Are you lying on an anthill?" "No," said Pippin, "but I'm not comfortable. I wonder how long it is since I slept in a bed."
Merry yawned. "Work it out on your fingers," he said.
"But you must know how long it is since we left Lorien."
"Oh, that," said Pippin. "I mean a real bed in a bedroom."
"Well, Rivendell, then," said Merry. "But I could sleep anywhere tonight."
"You had the luck, Merry," said Pippin softly, after a long pause. "You were riding with Gandalf."
"Well, what of it?"
"Did you get any news, any information out of him?"
"Yes, a good deal, more than usual. But you heard it all, or most of it. You were close by, and we were talking no secrets. But you can go with him tomorrow, if you think you'll get more out of him, and if he'll have you."
"Can I? Good. But he's close, isn't he? Not changed at all?"
"Oh, yes, he is," said Merry, waking up a little, and beginning to wonder what was bothering his companion. "He has grown, or something. He can be both kinder and more alarming, merrier and more solemn than before, I think. He's changed, but we've not had a chance to see him much yet. But think of the last part of that business with Saruman. Remember Saruman was once Gandalf's superior, head of the council, whatever that may be exactly. He was Saruman the White. Gandalf is the White now. Saruman came when he was told, and his rod was taken. And then he was just told to go, and he went."
"Well, if Gandalf has changed at all, then he's closer than ever, that's all," Pippin argued. "That glass ball, now. He seemed mighty pleased with it.
He knows or guesses something about it. But does he tell us what?"
"No, not a word. Yet I picked it up, and I saved it from rolling into a pool.
Here, I'll take that, my lad. That's all. I wonder what it is. It felt so very heavy. Pippin's voice fell very low, as if he was talking to himself. "Hallo," said Merry. "So that's what is bothering you. Now, Pippin, my lad, don't forget Gildor's saying, the one Sam used to quote, 'Do not meddle in the affairs of wizards, for they are subtle and quick to anger.' But our whole life for months has been one long meddling in the affairs of wizards," said Pippin. "I should like a bit of information as well as danger. I should like a look at that ball."
"Go to sleep," said Merry. "You'll get information enough sooner or later. My dear Pippin, no took ever beat a brandy buck for inquisitiveness. But is this the time, I ask you? All right. What's the harm in my telling you what I should like? A look at that stone. I know I can't have it, with old Gandalf sitting on it, like a hen on an egg, but it doesn't help much to get no more from you than a 'you can't have it, so go to sleep.'"
"Well, what else could I say?" said Merry. "I'm sorry, Pippin, but you really must wait till the morning. I'll be as curious as you like after breakfast, and I'll help in any way I can at wizard wheedling. But I can't keep awake any longer. If I yawn any more, I shall split at the ears. Good night."
Pippin said no more. He lay still now, but sleep remained far away, and it was not encouraged by the sound of Merry breathing softly, asleep in a few minutes after saying good night. The thought of the dark globe seemed to grow stronger as all grew quiet. Pippin felt again its weight in his hands, and saw again the mysterious red depths into which he had looked for a moment. He tossed and turned and tried to think of something else. At last he could stand it no longer. He got up and looked round. It was chilly, and he wrapped his cloak about him. The moon was shining cold and white, down into the dell, and the shadows of the bushes were black. All about lay sleeping shapes. The two guards were not in view. They were up on the hill, perhaps, or hidden in the bracken. Driven by some impulse that he did not understand, Pippin walked softly to where Gandalf lay. He looked down at him. The wizard seemed asleep, but with lids not fully closed. There was a glitter of eyes under his long lashes. Pippin stepped back hastily, but Gandalf made no sign, and drawn forward once more, half against his will, the hobbit crept up again from behind the wizard's head. He was rolled in a blanket, with his cloak spread over the top and close beside him. Between his right side and his bent arm there was a hummock, something round wrapped in a dark cloth. His hand seemed only just to have slipped off it to the ground. Hardly breathing, Pippin crept nearer, foot by foot. At last he knelt down. Then he put his hands out stealthily and slowly lifted the lump up. It didn't seem quite so heavy as he'd expected. "Only some bundle of oddments, perhaps, after all," he thought with a strange sense of relief. But he didn't put the bundle down again. He stood for a moment clasping it. Then an idea came into his mind. He tiptoed away, found a large stone, and came back. Quickly now he drew off the cloth, wrapped the stone in it, and, kneeling down, laid it back by the wizard's hand. Then at last he looked at the thing that he had uncovered. There it was, a smooth globe of crystal, now dark and dead, lying bare before his knees. Pippin lifted it, covered it hurriedly in his own cloak, and half turned to go back to his bed. At that moment Gandalf moved in his sleep, and muttered some words. They seemed to be in a strange tongue. His hand groped out and clasped the wrapped stone. Then he sighed and did not move again. "You idiotic fool," Pippin muttered to himself. "You're going to get yourself into frightful trouble. Put it back quick." But he found now that his knees quaked, and he didn't dare to go near enough to the wizard to reach the bundle. "I'll never get it back now without waking him," he thought. "Not till I'm a bit calmer. So I may as well have a look first. Not just here, though." He stole away, and sat down on a green hillock not far from his bed. The moon looked in over the edge of the dell. Pippin sat with his knees drawn up and the ball between them. He bent low over it, looking like a greedy child stooped over a bowl of food in a corner away from others.
He drew his cloak aside and gazed at it. The air seemed still and tense about him. At first the globe was dark, black as jet, with a moonlight gleaming on its surface. Then there came a faint glow and stir in the heart of it, and it held his eyes, so that now he could not look away. Soon all the inside seemed on fire, the ball was spinning, or the lights within were revolving. Suddenly the lights went out. He gave a gasp and struggled, but he remained bent, clasping the ball with both hands. Closer and closer he bent, and then became rigid. His lips moved soundlessly for a while. Then, with a strangled cry, he fell back and lay still. The cry was piercing. The guards leapt down from the banks. All the camp was soon astir.
"So this is the thief," said Gandalf.
Hastily he cast his cloak over the globe where it lay.
"But you, Pippin, this is a grievous turn to things."
He knelt by Pippin's body. The hobbit was lying on his back, rigid, with unseeing eyes staring up at the sky.
"The devilry! What mischief has he done, to himself and to all of us?"
The wizard's face was drawn and haggard. He took Pippin's hand and bent over his face, listening for his breath. Then he laid his hands on his brow. The hobbit shuddered. His eyes closed. He cried out and sat up, staring in bewilderment at all the faces round him, pale in the moonlight.
"It's not for you, Saruman,"
he cried in a shrill and toneless voice, shrinking away from Gandalf.
"I will send for it at once, do you understand? Say just that."
Then he struggled to get up and escape, but Gandalf held him gently and firmly.
"Peregrin took," he said, "come back."
The hobbit relaxed and fell back, clinging to the wizard's hand.
"Gandalf," he cried, "Gandalf, forgive me."
"Forgive you?" said the wizard. "Tell me first what you've done."
I took the ball and looked at it," stammered Pippin, "and I saw things that frightened me, and I wanted to go away, but I couldn't. And then he came and questioned me, and he looked at me, and that is all I remember."
"That won't do," said Gandalf sternly. "What did you see, and what did you say?"
Pippin shut his eyes and shivered, but said nothing. They all stared at him in silence, except Merry, who turned away. But Gandalf's face was still hard.
"Speak," he said. In a low, hesitating voice, Pippin began again, and slowly his words grew clearer and stronger.
"I saw a dark sky and tall battlements," he said, "and tiny stars. It seemed very far away and long ago, yet hard and clear. Then the stars went in and out. They were cut off by things with wings, very big, I think, really. But in the glass they looked like bats wheeling round the tower. I thought there were nine of them. One began to fly straight towards me, getting bigger and bigger. It had a horrible... No, I can't say. I tried to get away, because I thought it would fly out. But when it had covered all the globe, it disappeared. Then he came."
"He didn't speak so that I could hear words. He just looked, and I understood." "So you have come back. Why have you neglected to report for so long?"
"I didn't answer."
"He said, 'Who are you?'"
"I still didn't answer, but it hurt me horribly. And he pressed me, so I said, 'A hobbit.' Then suddenly he seemed to see me, and he laughed at me. It was cruel. It was like being stabbed with knives. I struggled, but he said,
'Wait a moment. We shall meet again soon. Tell Saruman that this dainty is not for him. I will send for it at once. Do you understand? Say just that.'
Then he gloated over me. I felt I was falling to pieces. No, I can't say any more. I don't remember anything else."
"Look at me," said Gandalf.
Pippin looked up straight into his eyes. The wizard held his gaze for a moment in silence. Then his face grew gentler, and the shadow of a smile appeared. He laid his hand softly on Pippin's head.
"All right," he said. "Say no more. You've taken no harm. There's no lie in your eyes, as I feared. But he didn't speak long with you. A fool, but an honest man, you remain, Peregrin Took. Wiser ones might have done worse in such a pass. But mark this. You've been saved, and all your friends too, mainly by good fortune, as it's called. You can't count on it a second time. If he'd questioned you, then and there, Almost certainly you would have told all that you know to the ruin of us all. But he was too eager. He didn't want information only. He wanted you, quickly, so that he could deal with you in the Dark Tower, slowly. Don't shudder. If you will meddle in the affairs of wizards, you must be prepared to think of such things. But come, I forgive you. Be comforted. Things have not turned out as evilly as they might. He lifted Pippin gently and carried him back to his bed. Merry followed and sat beside him. "Lie there and rest if you can, Pippin," said Gandalf. "Trust me. If you feel an itch in your palms again, tell me of it. Such things can be cured. But anyway, my dear hobbit, don't put a lump of rock under my elbow again. Now I'll leave you two together for a while." With that, Gandalf returned to the others, who were still standing by the Orthanc stone in troubled thought. "Peril comes in the night when least expected," he said. "We've had a narrow escape." "How is the hobbit, Pippin?" asked Aragorn. "I think all will be well now," answered Gandalf. "He was not held long, and hobbits have an amazing power of recovery. The memory, or the horror of it, will probably fade quickly, too quickly, perhaps. Will you, Aragorn, take the Orthanc stone and guard it? It's a dangerous charge." "Dangerous indeed, but not to all," said Aragorn. "There's one who may claim it by right. For this assuredly is the Palantir of Orthanc, from the treasury of Elendil, set here by the kings of Gondor. Now my hour draws near. I will take it." Gandalf looked at Aragorn, and then, to the surprise of the others, he lifted the covered stone and bowed as he presented it. "Receive it, Lord," he said, "in earnest of other things that shall be given back. But if I may counsel you in the use of your own, don't use it yet. Be wary." "When have I been hasty or unwary, who have waited and prepared for so many years?" asked Aragorn. "Never yet." "Don't then stumble at the end of the road," answered Gandalf. "But at the least keep this thing secret, you and all others that stand here. The hobbit, Peregrine, above all, should not know where it is bestowed. The evil fit may come on him again, for alas, he's handled it and looked in it, as should never have happened. He ought never to have touched it in Isengard, and there I should have been quicker. But my mind was bent on Saruman, and I didn't at once guess the nature of the stone. Then I was weary, and as I lay pondering it, sleep overcame me. Now I know." "Yes, there can be no doubt," said Aragorn. "At last we know the link between Isengard and Mordor, and how it worked. Much is explained." "Strange powers have our enemies, and strange weaknesses," said Theoden. "But it has long been said, oft evil will shall evil mar."
"That many times is seen," said Gandalf. "But at this time we have been strangely fortunate. Maybe I've been saved by this hobbit from a grave blunder. I'd considered whether or not to probe this stone myself to find its uses. Had I done so, I should have been revealed to him myself. I'm not ready for such a trial, if indeed I shall ever be so. But even if I found the power to withdraw myself, it would be disastrous for him to see me. Yet, until the hour comes when secrecy will avail no longer..."
"That hour is now come, I think," said Aragorn.
"Not yet," said Gandalf. "There remains a short while of doubt, which we must use. The enemy, it is clear, thought that the stone was in Orthanc. Why should he not? And that therefore the hobbit was captive there, driven to look in the glass for his torment by Saruman. That dark mind will be filled now with the voice and face of the hobbit and with expectation. It may take some time before he learns his error. We must snatch that time. We've been too leisurely. We must move. The neighbourhood of Isengard is no place to linger in. I will ride ahead at once with Peregrine Took. It will be better for him than lying in the dark while others sleep."
"I will keep Eomer and 10 riders," said the king. "They shall ride with me at early day. The rest may go with Aragorn and ride as soon as they have a mind."
"As you will," said Gandalf. "But make all the speed you may to the cover of the hills, to Helm's Deep." At that moment a shadow fell over them. The bright moonlight seemed to be suddenly cut off. Several of the riders cried out and crouched, holding their arms above their heads, as if to ward off a blow from above. A blind fear and a deadly cold fell on them. Cowering, they looked up. A vast winged shape passed over the moon like a black cloud. It wheeled and went north, flying at a speed greater than any wind of Middle-earth. The stars fainted before it. It was gone. They stood up, rigid as stones. Gandalf was gazing up, his arms out and downwards, stiff, his hands clenched.
"Nazgul!" he cried. "The messenger of Mordor! The storm is coming! The Nazgul have crossed the river! Ride, ride! Wait not for the dawn! Let not the swift wait for the slow! Ride!"
He sprang away, calling Shadowfax as he ran. Aragorn followed him. Going to Pippin, Gandalf picked him up in his arms. "You shall come with me this time," he said. "Shadowfax shall show you his paces." Then he ran to the place where he had slept. Shadowfax stood there ready. Slinging the small bag, which was all his luggage, across his shoulders, the wizard leapt upon the horse's back. Aragorn lifted Pippin and set him in Gandalf's arms, wrapped in cloak and blanket.
"Farewell! Follow fast!" cried Gandalf. "Away, Shadowfax!"
The great horse tossed his head. His flowing tail flicked in the moonlight. Then he leapt forward, spurning the earth, and was gone like the north wind from the mountains.
"A beautiful, restful night," said Merry to Aragorn. "Some folk have wonderful luck. He didn't want to sleep, and he wanted to ride with Gandalf, and there he goes, instead of being turned into a stone himself to stand here for ever as a warning.
If you had been the first to lift the Orthanc stone, and not he, how would it be now?" said Aragorn. "You might have done worse. Who can say? But now it's your luck to come with me, I fear. At once, go and get ready, and bring anything that Pippin left behind. Make haste."
Over the plains Shadowfax was flying, needing no urging and no guidance. Less than an hour had passed, and they had reached the fords of Isen and crossed them. The mound of the riders and its cold spears lay grey behind them. Pippin was recovering. He was warm, but the wind in his face was keen and refreshing. He was with Gandalf. The horror of the stone and of the hideous shadow over the moon was fading. Things left behind in the mists of the mountains or in a passing dream. He drew a deep breath.
"I didn't know you rode bareback, Gandalf," he said. "You haven't a saddle or a bridle."
"I don't ride elf fashion except on Shadowfax," said Gandalf. "But Shadowfax will have no harness. You don't ride Shadowfax. He's willing to carry you or not." "If he's willing, that's enough. It's then his business to see that you remain on his back unless you jump off into the air."
"How fast is he going?" asked Pippin. "Fast by the wind, but very smooth. And how light his footfalls are!"
"He's running now as fast as the swiftest horse could gallop," answered Gandalf. "But that is not fast for him. The land is rising a little here, and is more broken than it was beyond the river. But see how the white mountains are drawing near under the stars. Yonder are the three Heron peaks like black spears. It will not be long before we reach the branching roads and come to the Deeping Coombe, where the battle was fought 2 nights ago."
Pippin was silent again for a while. He heard Gandalf singing softly to himself, murmuring brief snatches of rhyme in many tongues as the miles ran under them. At last the wizard passed into a song of which the hobbit caught the words. A few lines came clearly to his ears through the rushing of the wind.
"Tall ships and tall kings, 3 times 3, what brought they from the founded land over the flowing sea? 7 stars and 7 stones, and 1 white tree.
"What are you saying, Gandalf?" asked Pippin.
"I was just running over some of the rhymes of lore in my mind," answered the wizard. "Hobbits, I suppose, have forgotten them, even those that they ever knew."
"No, not all," said Pippin. "And we have many of our own, which wouldn't interest you, perhaps. But I've never heard this one. What is it about, the 7 stars and 7 stones?"
"About the palantiri of the kings of old," said Gandalf.
"What are they?"
"The name meant that which looks far away. The Orthanc stone was one."
"Then it was not made? Not made?" Pippin hesitated. "By the enemy?"
"No," said Gandalf, "nor by Saruman. It's beyond his art, and beyond Sauron's too. The Palantiri came from beyond Westernus, from Eldamar. The Noldor made them. Feanor himself, maybe, wrought them, in days so long ago that the time cannot be measured in years. But there's nothing that Sauron cannot turn to evil uses. Alas for Saruman, it was his downfall, as I now perceive. Perilous to us all are the devices of an art deeper than we possess ourselves. Yet he must bear the blame. Fool to keep it secret, for his own profit. No word did he ever speak of it to any of the council. We hadn't yet given thought to the fate of the Palantiri of Gondor, in its ruinous wars. By men they were almost forgotten. Even in Gondor they were a secret known only to a few. In Arnor they were remembered only in a rhyme of lore among the Dunedain.
"What did the men of old use them for?" asked Pippin, delighted and astonished at getting answers to so many questions, and wondering how long it would last.
"To see far off, and to converse in thought with one another," said Gandalf. "In that way they long guarded and united the realm of Gondor. They set up stones at Minas Anor, and at Minas Ithil, and at Orthonk in the Ring of Isengard. The chief and master of these was under the dome of Stars of Osgiliath before its ruin. The three others were far away in the north. In the house of Elrond it's told that they were at Annúmenas and Amonsul, and Elendil's stone was on the tower hills that look towards Mithlond in the Gulf of Lune, where the grey ships lie. Each Palantir applies to each, but all those in Gondor were ever open to the view of Osgiliath. Now it appears that, as the rock of Orthonk has withstood the storms of time, so there the Palantir of that tower has remained. But alone it could do nothing but see small images of things far off and days remote. Very useful, no doubt, that was to Saruman. Yet it seems that he was not content. Further and further abroad he gazed, until he cast his gaze upon Barad-dûr. Then he was caught.
Who knows where the lost stones of Arnor and Gondor now lie, buried or drowned deep? But one at least Sauron must have obtained and mastered to his purposes. I guess it was the Ithil stone, for he took Minas Ithil long ago and turned it into an evil place. Minas Morgul it has become.
Easy it is now to guess how quickly the roving eye of Saruman was trapped and held, and how ever since he has been persuaded from afar, and daunted when persuasion would not serve. The biter bit, the hawk under the eagle's foot, the spider in a steel web. How long, I wonder, has he been constrained to come often to his glass for inspection and instruction, and the Orthanc stone so bent towards Barad-dûr that, if any save a will of adamant now looks into it, it will bear his mind and sight swiftly thither. And how it draws one to itself! Have I not felt it? Even now my heart desires to test my will upon it, to see if I could not wrench it from him and turn it where I would, to look across the wide seas of water and of time to Tirion the Fair, and perceive the unimaginable hand and mind of Feanor at their work, while both the white tree and the golden were in flower. He sighed and fell silent.
"I wish I'd known all this before," said Pippin. "I had no notion of what I was doing."
"Oh, yes, you had," said Gandalf. "You knew you were behaving wrongly and foolishly, and you told yourself so, though you didn't listen. I didn't tell you all this before, because it's only by musing on all that has happened that I've at last understood, even as we ride together. But if I'd spoken sooner, it wouldn't have lessened your desire or made it easier to resist. On the contrary, no, the burned hand teaches best. After that, advice about fire goes to the heart."
"It does," said Pippin. "If all the seven stones were laid out before me now, I should shut my eyes and put my hands in my pockets."
"Good," said Gandalf. "That is what I hoped."
"But I should like to know," Pippin began.
"Mercy," cried Gandalf. "If the giving of information is to be the cure of your inquisitiveness, I shall spend all the rest of my days in answering you. What more do you want to know?"
"The names of all the stars, and of all living things, and the whole history of Middle-earth, and over heaven, and of the sundering seas," laughed Pippin. "Of course, what less? But I'm not in a hurry tonight. At the moment I was just wondering about the Black Shadow. I heard you shout, 'Messenger of Mordor.' What was it? What could it do at Isengard?"
"It was a black rider on wings, a Nazgul," said Gandalf. "It could have taken you away to the Dark Tower."
"But it wasn't coming for me, was it?" faltered Pippin. "I mean, it didn't know that I had—"
"Of course not," said Gandalf. "It is 200 leagues or more in straight flight from Barad-dûr to Orthanc, and even a Nazgul would take a few hours to fly between them. But Saruman certainly looked in the stone since the Orc raid, and more of his secret thought, I do not doubt, has been read than he intended. A messenger has been sent to find out what he's doing, and after what has happened to-night another will come, I think, and swiftly. So Saruman will come to the last pinch of the vice that he has put his hand in. He has no captive to send, he has no stone to see with, and cannot answer the summons. Sauron will only believe that he is withholding the captive and refusing to use the stone. It will not help Saruman to tell the truth to the messenger, for Isengard may be ruined, yet he is still safe in Orthanc. So, whether he will or no, he will appear a rebel. Yet he rejected us, so as to avoid that very thing. What he will do in such a plight, I cannot guess. He has power still, I think, while in Orthanc, to resist the Nine Riders. He may try to do so. He may try to trap the Nazgul, or at least to slay the thing on which it now rides the air. In that case, let Rohan look to its horses. But I can't tell how it will fall out, well or ill for us. It may be that the counsels of the enemy will be confused, or hindered by his wrath with Saruman. It may be that he will learn that I was there, and stood upon the stairs of Orthanc, with hobbits at my tail, or that an heir of Elendil lives and stood beside me. If Wormtongue was not deceived by the armour of Rohan, he would remember Aragorn and the title that he claimed. That is what I fear. And so we fly, not from danger, but into greater danger. Every stride of Shadowfax bears you nearer to the land of shadow, Peregrine Took."
Pippin made no answer, but clutched his cloak, as if a sudden chill had struck him. Grey land passed under them.
"See now," said Gandalf, "the Westfold dales are opening before us. Here we come back to the eastward road. The dark shadow yonder is the mouth of the Deeping Combe. That way lies Aglarond and the Glittering Caves. Don't ask me about them. Ask Gimli if you meet again, and for the first time you may get an answer longer than you wish. You'll not see the caves yourself, not on this journey. Soon they will be far behind."
"I thought you were going to stop at Helm's Deep," said Pippin. "Where are you going, then?"
"To Minas Tirith, before the seas of war surround it."
"Oh, and how far is that?"
"Leagues upon leagues," answered Gandalf. "Thrice as far as the dwellings of King Theoden, and they are more than 100 miles east from here, as the messengers of Mordor fly. Shadowfax must run a longer road, which will prove the swifter. We shall ride now till daybreak, and that is some hours away. Then even Shadowfax must rest, in some hollow of the hills. At Edoras, I hope. Sleep, if you can. You may see the first glimmer of dawn upon the golden roof of the House of Eorl. And in 2 days thence you shall see the purple shadow of Mount Mindoluin, and the walls of the Tower of Denethor white in the morning. Away now, Shadowfax! Run, great heart! Run as you have never run before! Now we are come to the lands where you were foaled, and every stone you know. Run now! Hope is in speed!" Shadowfax tossed his head and cried aloud, as if a trumpet had summoned him to battle. Then he sprang forward. Fire flew from his feet. Night rushed over him. As he fell slowly into sleep, Pippin had a strange feeling. He and Gandalf were still as stone, seated upon the statue of a running horse, while the world rolled away beneath his feet with a great noise of wind.
Book 4 Chapter 1 The Taming of Smeagol.
"Well, master, we're in a fix and no mistake," said Sam Gamgee. He stood despondently with hunched shoulders beside Frodo and peered out with puckered eyes into the gloom. It was the third evening since they'd fled from the company, as far as they could tell. They had almost lost count of the hours during which they had climbed and laboured among the barren slopes and stones of the Emyn Muil, sometimes retracing their steps because they could find no way forward, sometimes discovering that they had wandered in a circle, back to where they had been hours before. Yet on the whole they had worked steadily eastward, keeping as near as they could find a way to the outer edge of this strange, twisted knot of hills. But always they found its outward faces sheer, high and impassable, frowning over the plain below. Beyond its tumbled skirts lay livid, festering marshes, where nothing moved and not even a bird was to be seen. The hobbit stood now on the brink of a tall cliff, bare and bleak, its feet wrapped in mist, and behind them rose the broken highlands, crowned with drifting cloud. A chill wind blew from the east. Night was gathering over the shapeless lands before them. The sickly green of them was fading to a sullen brown. Far away to the right, the Anduin, that had gleamed fitfully in sunbreaks during the day, was now hidden in shadow. But their eyes didn't look beyond the river, back to Gondor, to their friends, to the lands of men. South and east they stared, to where, at the edge of the oncoming night, a dark line hung, like distant mountains of motionless smoke. Every now and again a tiny red gleam far away flickered upwards on the rim of earth and sky.
"What a fix!" said Sam. "That's the one place in all the lands we've ever heard of that we don't want to see any closer, and that's the one place we're trying to get to, and that's just where we can't get, nohow. We've come the wrong way altogether, seemingly. We can't get down, and if we get down, we'll find all that green land a nasty bog, I'll warrant. Phew, can you smell it?" he sniffed at the wind.
"Yes, I can smell it," said Frodo, but he didn't move, and his eyes remained fixed, staring out towards the dark line and the flickering flame. "Mordor," he muttered under his breath. "If I must go there, I wish I could come there quickly and make an end." He shuddered. The wind was chilly and yet heavy with an odour of cold decay. "Well," he said, at last withdrawing his eyes, "we can't stay here all night, fix or no fix. We must find a more sheltered spot, and camp once more, and perhaps another day will show us a path."
"Or another and another and another," muttered Sam. "Or maybe no day. We've come the wrong way."
"I wonder," said Frodo. "It's my doom, I think, to go to that shadow yonder, so that a way will be found. But will good or evil show it to me? What hope we had was in speed. Delay plays into the enemy's hands, and here I am, delayed. Is it the will of the Dark Tower that steers us? All my choices have proved ill. I should have left the company long before, and come down from the north, east of the river and of the Emyn Muil, and so over the hard of Battle Plain to the passes of Mordor. But now it isn't possible for you and me alone to find a way back, and the orcs are prowling on the east bank. Every day that passes is a precious day lost. I'm tired, Sam. I don't know what's to be done. What food have we got left?"
"Only those, what you call 'em, lembas, Mr. Frodo. A fair supply. But they're better than naught by a long bite. I never thought, though, when I first set tooth in them, that I should ever come to wish for a change. But I do now. A bit of plain bread and a mug, aye, half a mug, of beer would go down proper. I've lugged my cooking gear all the way from the last camp, and what use has it been? Naught to make a fire with for a start, and naught to cook, not even grass."
They turned away and went down into a stony hollow. The westering sun was caught into clouds, and night came swiftly. They slept as well as they could for the cold, turn and turn about,
in a nook among great jagged pinnacles of weathered rock. At least they were sheltered from the easterly wind.
"Did you see them again, Mr. Frodo?" asked Sam, as they sat, stiff and chilled, munching wafers of Lembas in the cold grey of early morning.
"No," said Frodo. "I've heard nothing and seen nothing for 2 nights now."
"Nor me," said Sam. "Grr! Those eyes did give me a turn. But perhaps we've shaken him off at last, the miserable slinker. Gollum! I'll give him Gollum in his throat if ever I get my hands on his neck."
"I hope you'll never need to," said Frodo. "I don't know how he followed us, but it may be that he's lost us again, as you say.
In this dry, bleak land we can't leave many footprints, nor much scent, even for his snuffling nose."
"I hope that's the way of it," said Sam. "I wish we could be rid of him for good."
"So do I," said Frodo. "But he's not my chief trouble. I wish we could get away from these hills. I hate them. I feel all naked on the east side, stuck up here with nothing but the dead flats between me and that shadow yonder. There's an eye in it. Come on. We've got to get down today somehow."
But that day wore on, and when afternoon faded towards evening, they were still scrambling along the ridge and had found no way of escape. Sometimes in the silence of that barren country they fancied that they heard faint sounds behind them, a stone falling, or the imagined step of flapping feet on the rock. But if they halted and stood still listening, they heard no more. Nothing but the wind sighing over the edges of the stones. Yet even that reminded them of breath softly hissing through sharp teeth. All that day the outer ridges of the Emyn Muil had been bending gradually northward as they struggled on. Along its brink there now stretched a wide, tumbled flat of scored and weathered rock, cut every now and again by trench-like gullies that sloped steeply down to deep notches in the cliff face. To find a path in these clefts, which were becoming deeper and more frequent, Frodo and Sam were driven to their left, well away from the edge, and they didn't notice that for several miles they'd been going slowly but steadily downhill. The cliff-top was sinking towards the level of the lowlands. At last they were brought to a halt. The ridge took a sharper bend northward and was gashed by a deeper ravine. On the further side it reared up again, many fathoms at a single leap. A great grey cliff loomed before them, cut sheer down as if by a knife-stroke. They could go no further forwards, and must turn now either west or east. But west would lead them only into more labour and delay, back towards the hearts of the hills. East would take them to the outer precipice.
"There's nothing for it but to scramble down this gully, Sam," said Frodo. "Let's see what it leads to."
"A nasty drop, I'll bet," said Sam.
The cleft was longer and deeper than it seemed. Some way down they found a few gnarled and stunted trees, the first they had seen for days. Twisted birch for the most part, with here and there a fir tree. Many were dead and gaunt, bitten to the core by the eastern winds. Once in milder days there must have been a fair thicket in the ravine, but now, after some 50 yards, the trees came to an end, though old broken stumps straggled on almost to the cliff's brink. The bottom of the gully, which lay along the edge of a rock fault, was rough with broken stone and slanted steeply down. When they came at last to the end of it, Frodo stooped and leaned out.
"Look," he said. "We must have come down a long way, or else the cliff has sunk. It's much lower here than it was, and it looks easier, too."
Sam knelt beside him and peered reluctantly over the edge. Then he glanced up at the great cliff rising up, away on their left.
"Easier," he grunted. "Well, I suppose it's always easier getting down than up. Those as can't fly can jump."
"It would be a big jump still," said Frodo. "About, well," he stood for a moment, measuring it with his eyes, "about 18 fathoms, I should guess, not more."
"And that's enough," said Sam.
"Ah, how I do hate looking down from a height. But looking's better than climbing."
"All the same," said Frodo, I think we could climb here, and I think we shall have to try. See, the rock is quite different from what it was a few miles back. It has slipped and cracked.
The outer fall was indeed no longer sheer, but sloped outwards a little. It looked like a great rampart or sea wall whose foundations had shifted, so that its courses were all twisted and disordered, leaving great fissures and long slanting edges that were in places almost as wide as stairs.
"And if we're going to try and get down, we'd better try at once. It's getting dark early. I think there's a storm coming."
The smoky blur of the mountains in the east was lost in a deeper blackness that was already reaching out westward with long arms. There was a distant mutter of thunder borne on the rising breeze. Frodo sniffed the air and looked up doubtfully at the sky. He strapped his belt outside his cloak and tightened it, and settled his light pack on his back. Then he stepped towards the edge.
"I'm going to try it," he said.
"Very good," said Sam gloomily. "But I'm going first."
"You," said Frodo. "What's made you change your mind about climbing?"
"I haven't changed my mind, but it's only sense. Put the one lowest as is most likely to slip. I don't want to come down atop of you and knock you off. No sense in killing two with one fall."
Before Frodo could stop him, he sat down, swung his legs over the brink, and twisted round, scrabbling with his toes for a foothold. It is doubtful if he ever did anything braver in cold blood, or more unwise.
"No, no, Sam, you old ass," said Frodo. "You'll kill yourself for certain going over like that, without even a look to see what to make for. Come back."
He took Sam under the armpits and hurled him up again.
"Now wait a bit and be patient," he said.
Then he lay on the ground, leaning out and looking down, but the light seemed to be fading quickly, although the sun had not yet set.
"I think we can manage this," he said presently.
"I could at any rate, and you could too, if you kept your head and followed me carefully."
"I don't know how you can be so sure," said Sam.
"Why, you can't see to the bottom in this light. What if you comes to a place where there's nowhere to put your feet or your hands?"
"Climb back, I suppose," said Frodo.
"Easy said," objected Sam. "Better wait till morning and more light."
"No,
not if I can help it," said Frodo, with a sudden strange vehemence. "I grudge every hour, every minute. I'm going down to try it out. Don't you follow till I come back or call."
Gripping the stony lip of the fall with his fingers, he let himself gently down, until when his arms were almost at full stretch, his toes found a ledge.
"One step down," he said, "and this ledge broadens out to the right. I could stand there without a hold.
His words were cut short. The hurrying darkness, now gathering great speed, rushed up from the east and swallowed the sky. There was a dry, splitting crack of thunder right overhead. Searing lightning smote down into the hills. Then came a blast of savage wind, and with it, mingling with its roar, there came a high, shrill shriek. The hobbits had heard just such a cry far away in the Marish as they fled from Hobbiton, and even there, in the woods of the Shire, it had frozen their blood. Out here in the waste its terror was far greater. It pierced them with cold blades of horror and despair, stopping heart and breath. Sam fell flat on his face. Involuntarily, Frodo loosed his hold and put his hands over his head and ears. He swayed, slipped, and slithered downwards with a wailing cry. Sam heard him and crawled with an effort to the edge.
"Master! Master!" he called. "Master!"
He heard no answer. He found he was shaking all over, but he gathered his breath, and once again he shouted, "Master!" The wind seemed to blow his voice back into his throat, but as it passed, roaring up the gully and away over the hills, a faint answering cry came to his ears.
"All right, all right. I'm here, but I can't see."
Frodo was calling with a weak voice. He wasn't actually very far away. He'd slid and not fallen, and had come up with a jolt to his feet on a wider ledge not many yards lower down. Fortunately, the rock face at this point leaned well back, and the wind had pressed him against the cliff, so that he hadn't toppled over. He steadied himself a little, laying his face against the cold stone, feeling his heart pounding, but either the darkness had grown complete, or else his eyes had lost their sight. All was black about him. He wondered if he'd been struck blind. He took a deep breath. "Come back! Come back!" he heard Sam's voice out of the blackness above. "I can't," he said. "I can't see. I can't find any hold. I can't move yet."
"What can I do, Mr. Frodo? What can I do?" shouted Sam, leaning out dangerously far.
Why couldn't his master see? It was dim, certainly, but not as dark as all that. He could see Frodo below him, a grey, forlorn figure splayed against the cliff. But he was far out of the reach of any helping hand.
There was another crack of thunder, and then the rain came. In a blinding sheet, mingled with hail, it drove against the cliff, bitter cold.
"I'm coming down to you," shouted Sam,
though how he hoped to help in that way he could not have said.
"No, no, wait," Frodo called back more strongly now. "I shall be better soon. I feel better already. Wait. You can't do anything without a rope."
"Rope!"
cried Sam, talking wildly to himself in his excitement and relief.
"Well, if I don't deserve to be hung on the end of one as a warning to numbskulls, you're nowt but a ninny hammer, Sam Gamgee. That's what the gaffer said to me often enough, it being a word of his. Rope!"
"Stop chattering," cried Frodo, now recovered enough to feel both amused and annoyed.
"Never mind your gaffer. Are you trying to tell yourself you've got some rope in your pocket? If so, out with it."
"Yes, Mr. Frodo, in my pack and all. Carried it hundreds of miles, and I'd clean forgotten it.
Then get busy and let an end down."
Quickly Sam unslung his pack and rummaged in it. There indeed at the bottom was a coil of the silken grey rope made by the folk of Lorien. He cast an end to his master. The darkness seemed to lift from Frodo's eyes, or else his sight was returning. He could see the grey line as it came dangling down, and he thought it had a faint silver sheen. Now that he had some point in the darkness to fix his eyes on, he felt less giddy. Leaning his weight forward, he made the end fast to his waist, and then he grasped the line with both hands. Sam stepped back and braced his feet against a stump a yard or two from the edge. Half-hauled, half-scrambling, Frodo came up and threw himself on the ground. Thunder growled and rumbled in the distance, and the rain was still falling heavily. The hobbits crawled away back into the gully, but they didn't find much shelter there. Rills of water began to run down. Soon they grew to a spate that splashed and fumed on the stones and spouted out over the hill like the gutters of a vast roof.
"I should have been half drowned down there, or washed clean off," said Frodo. "What a piece of luck you had that rope."
"Better luck if I'd thought of it sooner," said Sam.
"Maybe you remember them putting the ropes in the boats as we started off, in the Elvish country? I took a fancy to it, and I stowed a coil in my pack. Years ago, it seems."
"It may be a help in many needs," he said. "Haldir, or one of those folk. And he spoke right."
"A pity I didn't think of bringing another length," said Frodo. "But I left the company in such a hurry and confusion. If only we'd enough, we could use it to get down. How long's your rope, I wonder?"
Sam paid it out slowly, measuring it with his arms. 5, 10, 20, 30 ells, more or less," he said.
"Who'd have thought it?" Frodo exclaimed.
"Ah, who would?" said Sam. "Elves are wonderful folk. It looks a bit thin, but it's tough, and soft as milk to the hand. Packs close, too, and as light as light. Wonderful folk, to be sure."
30 ells, said Frodo, considering. "I believe it would be enough. If the storm passes before nightfall, I'm going to try it."
"The rain's nearly given over already," said Sam. "But don't you go doing anything risky in the dim again, Mr. Frodo. And I haven't got over that shriek on the wind yet, if you have. Like a black rider it sounded, but one up in the air, if they can fly. I'm thinking we'd best lay up in this crack till night's over."
and I'm thinking that I won't spend a moment longer than I need, stuck up on this edge with the eyes of the dark country looking over the marshes," said Frodo. With that he stood up and went down to the bottom of the gully again. He looked out. Clear sky was growing in the east once more. The skirts of the storm were lifting, ragged and wet, and the main battle had passed to spread its great wings over the Emyn Muil, upon which the dark thought of Sauron brooded for a while. Thence it turned, smiting the vale of Anduin with hail and lightning, and casting its shadow upon Minas Tirith with threat of war. Then, lowering in the mountains, and gathering its great spires, it rolled on slowly over Gondor and the skirts of Rohan, until far away the riders on the plain saw its black towers moving behind the sun as they rode into the west. But here, over the desert and the reeking marshes, the deep blue sky of evening opened once more, and a few pallid stars appeared, like small white holes in the canopy above the crescent moon. "It's good to be able to see again," said Frodo, breathing deep. "Do you know, I thought for a bit that I'd lost my sight, from the lightning or something else worse. I could see nothing, nothing at all, until the grey rope came down. It seemed to shimmer somehow." "It does look sort of silver in the dark," said Sam. "Never noticed it before, though I can't remember as I've ever had it out since I first stowed it. But if you're so set on climbing, Mr. Frodo, how are you going to use it?" 30 ells, or say about 18 fathom, that's no more than your guess at the height of the cliff." Frodo thought for a while. "Make it fast to that stump, Sam," he said. "Then I think you shall have your wish this time and go first. I'll lower it, and you need do no more than use your feet and hands to fend yourself off the rock. Though, if you put your weight on some of the ledges and give me a rest, it'll help. When you're down, I'll follow. I feel quite myself again now." "Very well," said Sam heavily. "If it must be, let's get it over." He took up the rope and made it fast over the stump nearest to the brink. Then the other end he tied about his own waist. Reluctantly he turned and prepared to go over the edge a second time. It did not, however, turn out half as bad as he had expected. The rope seemed to give him confidence, though he shut his eyes more than once when he looked down between his feet. There was one awkward spot, where there was no ledge and the wall was sheer and even undercut for a short space. There he slipped and swung out on the silver line. But Frodo lowered him slowly and steadily, and it was over at last. His chief fear had been that the rope length would give out while he was still high up, but there was still a good bite in Frodo's hands when Sam came to the bottom and called up, "I'm down!" His voice came up clearly from below, but Frodo couldn't see him. His grey elven cloak had melted into the twilight. Frodo took rather more time to follow him. He had the rope about his waist, and it was fast above, and he'd shortened it so that it would pull him up before he reached the ground. Still, he didn't want to risk a fall, and he hadn't quite Sam's faith in this slender grey line. He found two places, all the same, where he had to trust wholly to it. Smooth surfaces where there was no hold even for his strong hobbit fingers, and the ledges were far apart. But at last he too was down. "Well," he cried, "we've done it. We've escaped from the Emyn Muil. And now what next, I wonder? Maybe we shall soon be sighing for good hard rock underfoot again." But Sam didn't answer. He was staring back up the cliff. "Ninny hammers," he said. "Noodles, my beautiful rope! There it is tied to a stump, and we're at the bottom. Just as nice a little stair for that slinking golem as we could leave. Better put up a signpost to say which way we've gone. I thought it seemed a bit too easy. If you can think of any way we could have both used the rope and yet brought it down with us, then you can pass on to me Ninny Hammer, or any other name your gaffer gave you," said Frodo. "Climb up and untie it and let yourself down if you want to." Sam scratched his head. "No, I can't think how, begging your pardon," he said. "But I don't like leaving it, and that's a fact." He stroked the rope's end and shook it gently. "It goes hard parting with anything I brought out of the elf country, made by Galadriel